What a great pleasure to talk to one of my favorite comic book artists and writers and inkers of all time, being a hardcore DC kid. It's a pleasure to talk to Mr. Jerry Ordway. Thank you, Jerry, for spending some time with me.
Oh, thank you very much.
I got to tell you, I'm a huge fan, so this is a blast for me. And given the box office numbers this weekend, it would be crazy of me not to start our conversation off with your relationship with Shazam.
Oh, sure.
In 1994, of course, you created The Power of Shazam, one of my favorite graphic novels. What was your initial attraction to the character? How did you get involved with Shazam?
Age-wise, I'm probably at that age when DC was doing a lot of licensing, and they had restarted Shazam and or formerly Captain Marvel in like 1973. So it was probably the right age to kind of get indoctrinated into it.
Right.
And I always thought it was a cool costume, but I wound up drawing a little bit, and I think All-Star Squadron, maybe we did some stuff. I did a couple covers and things like that, but and mostly in Crisis on Infinite Earths that I really kind of was more or less, you know, thinking, wow, this stuff does have some potential. But I was a big, like I said, I was mostly a fan of the 70s stuff. I was probably, you know, too young for the 50s or the 40s stuff.
Sure.
But there were still a lot of fans from that era that were, you'd go into a comic store or a secondhand store and they'd be telling you about the great Captain Marvel comics of their childhood. So it always had that kind of aura. You always knew, even if, you know, I was a Marvel comics fan mostly, but you always knew, well, this, you know, people really love that stuff. So that previous generation kind of helped sell you on the idea that this was an important character in some ways, you know.
How did the idea come about to sort of revise his origin and bring the story up to date? Was that yours, or was that did it come from an editor?
When I was asked to do it, it was originally going to be John Byrne, and Byrne had quit over a justifiable, you know, inter-office kind of thing, editorial thing. And when I was asked, the editor I'd worked with on the Batman movie comic in 89, Jonathan Peterson, had asked me about, hey, come on, I want you to do Shazam. We can try, we can do this. And then he introduced me to the Republic serial, which kind of ignited a different level, you know, in my head. I was like, wow, this, you know, there has been stuff done that wasn't, you know, like really too cutesy or whatever. Like some of the 50s, yeah, I want to say 40s stuff, it got a little bit too cutesy.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, it certainly had that charm. But I grew up with, you know, Stan Lee, Jack Kirby, Steve Ditko, you know, that type of conflicted hero. And so that was kind of my goal, was to try to update it to really 60s sensibilities from 40s sensibilities. So I used Spider-Man as my template, really, because that was my favorite Marvel comic as a kid. So I just tried to give him a little complexity. And Jonathan and I both had decided we wanted to try to make this our Shazam movie adaptation. We said, okay, we did the Batman movie thing. What if we approach this as if this is a comic book adaptation of the Shazam movie? So that's why we wanted to go big with, I mean, there's Egyptian stuff, there's the temples, there's a World's Fair. It was, you know, elements that we thought would be almost perfect for a movie.
Yeah, it is very cinematic in scope. And like you said, the set pieces, there's almost sort of an Indiana Jones feel with the archaeology.
Oh, yeah. Yep, both of us were big fans of Indiana Jones.
And it makes for a great tie-in when you bring back Teth Adam and the whole scarab thing and all that all works out. Was it planned to be a one-off initially, or was there always a plan to go forward with a series?
I was only asked to do the graphic novel. And again, my goal was just to, at that in those days, nothing really was shelvable. There was no a lot of collections of your monthly comics. So as much as I loved doing like the Superman stuff, it felt like that was never going to get collected. And I was a little jealous of other people getting to do, you know, like a book that was a hardcover that had a square binding that would sit on a shelf. So it was initially just that. But once I'd finished the graphic novel, I know that they'd always wanted me to continue it, because that was the end goal, was to try to incorporate the character kind of fully into the more wide-ranging DC universe.
Right.
So, you know, establish a geographical location for Fawcett City, and you know, all that. That was definitely a goal, and to make it available that, you know, hey, Batman could show up or what have you. So that was, you know, always in the on the back burner. It just was a matter of, at the time, I'd had I was just starting, you know, my wife and I were just starting our family, and I was trying not to be as crazily busy on deadlines, even though that didn't always work out. That was the goal. So, but again, it took me a couple of years, kind of as a side job, to do the graphic novel, because I painted the pages as well, which was a big thing for me. I wanted, you know, I wanted it to be the, okay, here's my Jerry Ordway project. I wrote it, you know, I drew it, I colored it, you know, I didn't letter it. John Costanza lettered it, so, but I felt like it was something I could call my own, as opposed to, you know, several years of working on Superman, where you're kind of a part of a team rather than an individual. You know, you always were, you know, you were like the forward on the basketball team. You weren't the star player necessarily. Everybody had to kind of pitch in together. So this was the one, you know, time I could actually show off a bit, I guess.
Yeah, you did it all. And were you interested in writing comics at the start, or did you come into the business primarily just thinking about being an artist?
No, I guess most people probably go through that. When I was a kid, I had my own characters that I came up with and I wrote stories for. So I never really thought of it as one job or another. It was like I always felt like I wanted to be able to do all of it.
Mm-hmm.
And again, even I do have a lettering credit, so I guess I hit that mark early, but I always felt like that the more diverse you could be, the better your chances of survival were as well. But I would also admit that I am a little bit of a control freak, even though I work well with others. I do have my, as we used to joke in the family, there's the right way, the wrong way, and the org way. That kind of indicated that, you know, we all had our specific way of doing things. So, but I always wanted to do more. And when I got into comics, I was originally a finisher, so I wasn't doing pencils, but I wanted to pencil. So, you know, at each stage, you have to fight for kind of to break out of whatever the perception of you is. And I know when I, you know, started penciling, I had to quit my book that I was working on, All-Star Squadron. I had to quit it to get penciling work. And then they said, well, if you're going to quit, why don't you stay on and we'll just replace you and you can be the penciler. So then I, you know, as long as they guaranteed that the guy who had been penciling it wasn't going to lose work, I was okay with that. And I got to write while I was on Superman after, you know, a couple of years of proving myself with ideas and things. So I felt like each stage was kind of, you know, a little bit working towards the goal of when I was a kid writing and drawing my own, you know, stories.
Right. As you mentioned, when you first started working with DC, primarily you were inking other artists. Was that a source of frustration for you, being a writer and artist yourself?
It is, and it was to a degree, only in that they, in those days when you did one thing, and if you did it well, that's what you did. It was hard to break out of whatever little box they would put you in, and it was hard financially too, because you could get used to, you know, say inking 2-3 pages a day, and then your income level, if you multiply that, you get paid per page. You'd say, okay, if I were to quit and to start penciling, am I going to be able to pencil a full book per month? How much is my income going to take a hit to do this?
So right.
In my brain, it was always better to try to do make a move like that early on before I got, you know, trapped, I guess, by a specific, you know, specific income level or needing a specific income level. But yeah, it's always interesting because, you know, when I was working on Superman, and John Byrne and I worked really well together on the Superman books. He was plotting at one point. He had offered me co-plotting, so I used to do story conferences at his house, and then we'd go out to lunch and stuff. So we were like real friendly and stuff. And when he'd left, Mike Carlin had given me the opportunity to write. And then John used to kid me. He's like, "Uh-oh, another artist who thinks he's a writer," and he meant it totally in jest.
Right.
But there were people in the industry who didn't mean that in jest. You know, there was. I always felt like I had proven myself, and no one handed me something that I didn't earn, I think. But I, you know, I do know that a lot of writers, or a lot of mainstream writers, were a little threatened by the that wave in the 80s of, you know, like Byrne and Simonson and Frank Miller. And, you know, it kind of kept growing, and basically it just kept taking top-level artists away from, you know, collaborating with writers. So right. I could see they felt threatened. But yeah, anytime you try to break out of a, you know, whatever kind of cage someone puts you in, it requires a little bit of effort, and you also have to put up a little bit of, you know, scrutiny. Is this guy good enough? And, you know, here I was writing Superman. But, you know, people could look at that. They don't realize they've been on it for a couple of years at that point, and that, you know, several ideas that were well-received were ideas that I pitched or whatever. So
let's talk a little bit about your time on Superman, with the Adventures of Superman. You started with Byrne on Man of Steel, right?
No. I started with on Adventures of Superman with Marv Wolfman.
Oh, okay.
Man of Steel came out, it was like a 6-issue miniseries, and then they relaunched the 3 books. It was Action Comics and Superman were both written and drawn by John Byrne, and then Adventures, we were like the, third part of that. And Marv I hadn't even been involved in much of the story stuff at that point. Marv had, I guess, staked out some space, you know, here's the stories I want to tell, so that we didn't duplicate exactly what John did. And you know, the idea was to go take that title and run with it and do it kind of in the vein of the maybe first couple of seasons of the old 1950s George Reeves TV show, to do it more crime-oriented and explore a little bit of the street-level crime,
right,
as opposed to, you know, Superman fighting in outer space or whatever.
Less aliens. And you did absolutely push the mythos of Superman forward, because you were in the middle of Clark Kent proposing to Lois, right? That was during your run. And then, of course, the death of Superman. You were right there in the middle of that, which was not only a game changer in comics, but it was a pop culture phenomenon that sort of shook the world.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was definitely like being, for that brief period of a couple of years there, you were like, you know, had the scrutiny and the people following you around and stuff. It was a little bit like, you know, being a celebrity just for a short period. It really gives you a sense of how you understand how people can value privacy, even if it's just not being bothered while you go out to have a drink or something like that. It was a little crazy. But again, it was fun, and I think it came in an honest way, because whatever we had done, I think people realized that it wasn't just a stunt, that it had some emotional resonance. So I felt like we won that battle. I mean, that was my whole, if we were going to do this, that we had to make it, actually approach it on a human level. And that's, to me, you know, I'd done Crisis, I'd done big storylines. I felt like when you do these things, for me, the interest level is always, how does it affect a normal guy? And that's, you know, I think that's what, reading Spider-Man as a kid, there was always that street level aspect of Spider-Man. He wasn't like, he wasn't in the Avengers then. He was, you know, kind of the outcast hero, but he still was grounded by all of his problems, you know, with Aunt May and all that stuff. So, that was important to me in the Death of Superman, that you show not just a lot of empty warehouses being destroyed. If you're going to do it, show people being put out of their homes, show a whole city being, you know, put out of, you know, out of their normal routine. So
right.
It wouldn't just be he's dead. Okay, next month, Brainiac attacks or whatever. So.
And I found, too, during that arc, the emotional resonance of the people who loved Clark, you know, not just Superman, but those ripples that affected the Superman family around him, very emotionally sort of effective. And I thought that was a strong suit of that arc.
Oh, yeah. And one of that shows the value of the stories that we did in the several years before that, because we really explored those relationships. Each of the, when we first started out after John Byrne had left, we were doing Action, Roger Stern and Cary Gamble, and then I was doing Adventures. And then when the books expanded to include, you know, well, actually, see, that was a thing. Action Comics had, this is so complicated. Action Comics had been given up to become a weekly, And then, so there was a period of time when Byrne was doing two issues of Superman a month. When he left, it went back to one. So like I said, we had two books as opposed to what was three. Then we added a third one when Action came back into the, you know, and then we had Man of Steel. So by the time we had that, we had each four different books that had slightly different flavors and slightly different supporting cast. So you get a chance to develop those characters, and people still, you know, I think I still get responses from people about Bibbo and Professor Hamilton and Cat Grant and all that. And that's gratifying because, you know, for our little period of time, we made those, you know, fans care about regular guys, you know.
Speaking of Bibbo, real quickly, I got to tell you what a kick it was for me to see your chapter in Action Comics 1000, the 5 minutes that you did. It was just, I mean, I'm such a fan. It was great to see you revisit those characters in that world. Did you have a good time doing that?
Oh, yeah. And when they'd offered me, you know, said, oh, we want to do a short story in this, I was like, sure. And they said, well, we already have, you know, some people in mind for you to write, to work on with. And I said, well, why not Roger Stern or Louise? You know, I said, Louise Simonson. I don't think I'd really done much with Louise. When I was on the books, I was the writer. I wasn't really even drawing the books when Louise had started on the Man of Steel book.
Mm-hmm.
So they put me together with Louise, who I know really well, obviously. She said, is there anything specific you'd like to draw on this? And I said, well, I'd love to bring back Bibbo. You know, she said, you got it. So whatever she had put in the script, I added a few little extra bits. And it's just fun because, you know, you spend years, this was back in the 90s, you know, here we are revisiting it years later. It was fun just to kind of feel like you were sliding right into a groove. You know, it wasn't like, oh my God, what does this character look like? Or what is, you know, Metropolis changes or whatever, depending on the era and the people drawing it. But
yeah.
Ultimately, it's nice to have stuff that you feel like, oh, I wasn't away for all these years. I felt right, you know, right in tune. So the frustrating part, of course, is that when you do something like that, at the end of it, you go, oh, well, there's no more.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like being being warmed up for an exercise and then being done or something, you know.
When you've been in the center of so many important comic book events, like you mentioned, Crisis and the death of Superman, do you feel in retrospect now, as you've, you know, since in the years since, that maybe the comic industry relies a little bit too heavily on those events now because they were so huge and successful at the time? Has the effect worn off to where they're not quite as impactful anymore?
You mean when they do new ones?
Yeah.
Or when,
like we seem to live in a world of constant reboots and constant deaths and rebirths. And the things that you guys sort of set into motion now have become the norm.
Yeah. No, I felt that even in the 90s, because when I was doing the Power Shazam comic, I think we lasted for pretty much 4 years as a monthly book. And during that 4 years, we did at least five tie-ins to crossovers. I mean, there had to have been, maybe there was even more, but I know at the very least there was about five, which is exhausting, but at least those weren't things that restarted everything.
Yeah.
You know, I think as a comic reader, which I still read stuff, I still love the characters, still go to the comic store every week, I feel like there's a fatigue that sets in as a reader where I realize, okay, I've aged out of their demographic, but what I always liked was I liked the continuity, and I liked the fact that whatever you picked up a Spider-Man or a Captain America or Avengers or whatever, there was a thread that ran from their very first issue through whatever you were reading.
Right.
It didn't require you to know all that stuff, but it was nice to know that it existed, and that, to me, that they've cut that thread maybe too many times where it's no longer, it's not as interesting to me for that reason. I mean, I always felt bad when Marvel finally kind of threw things in the air and, you know, it's like, well, wait, what is still canon and what's not?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've had that for years with Superman, obviously, because Superman never had a tremendous continuity until I think we did it. There really was no sense of, once Man of Steel came, we had a beginning point that we could then reintroduce stuff with, but, you know, so people would go, oh, which Superman is this? Is this the Superman with Brainiac and the big ship, and is this Lex Luthor in his, you know, robotic power suit, and, you know, that was always a confusion to me that I didn't like, you know, and that probably wasn't my appeal, the DC appeal. I love the fact that Marvel had that, you know, big tapestry that everything was still part of, you know.
Right. I think you bring up an excellent point. A lot of readers feel like time when they read the comics is spent with old friends, and when you sever those memories and those relationships, it's hard to connect up.
Definitely, definitely. And then you're right, because most of us probably read books, and they were a comfort to us, whether we think of it as, oh, it was summertime childhood stuff, or we read them for longer periods. You do, again, have that connection with the character. I mean, here it is, how many years later, I haven't read a Spider-Man comic for a while because I just haven't felt like I could catch on to whatever was happening with it. But I still love the character, and I still have fond memories of the long run of the books that I have in my collection, you know.
Right.
So they do, you know, they do feel, not, I know they're not real, but you do feel that friend, almost like I said, a friendship, you know, because you've gone through all these different adventures with them, you know.
Right, sure.
I guess it's probably the way to, you know, equate it is people, you have online friends who you've never met in your whole life, but you kind of experience their life through whatever they're posting. Oh, mm-hmm. This happened to me, that happened to me. So it's almost like that in a way. You know, it's almost like a semi-detached, but yet you still know their history, you know, and you do have feelings for them, even if you've never met them. That's a weird thing, but it just popped into my head. But I do feel that. I'm sure you have people online that you know, interact with that maybe you haven't met or maybe met once or twice, and you do place kind of a friendship, you know, equivalent on that, because
sure.
You are experiencing a lot of their day if they have a bad day or if something happens to them or whatever. So,
you know, speaking of some of your special projects, I did want to touch on this because I was always so impressed by this book. But when you did that comic adaptation of the 89 Batman movie, mm-hmm. Your work with the likenesses of the characters I thought was great. Is that challenging as an artist to have to, as opposed to having the creative freedom of making the characters look like you want them to have to be sort of slavishly dedicated to the likenesses of Jack Nicholson or Keaton or something like that?
Well, you know what the challenge is? The challenge is, like, if you were doing it and making it up yourself, you would ultimately have to find some kind of visual model for a character anyways. So as long as you have a decent amount of reference, you know, to get a likeness, for example, like with the Batman book, we had, you know, good cooperation with Warner Brothers and Pinewood Studios and the set photographers that we had pretty much, you know, like 80% of what we needed, which was better than most other projects could have been. You know,
right.
maybe L. Williamson had better reference from Star Wars because of the, you know, George Lucas connection or whatever, but generally, they're in the years since, these companies have gotten way more restrictive, and I've continued to do them. I did a Supergirl storyline that was tied to the Man of Steel that, you know, has never been in a print edition, but it was Walmart digital download. It was a 40-page Supergirl kind of origin tied to the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So I had you know, need of reference and things like that, and it was like pulling teeth, you know. In a digital age, it's just funny because they worry more about piracy and things leaking.
Right.
Yet you're still signing the same non-disclosures. And I did Green Lantern when that was, they did movie prequels for Green Lantern. I had to do likenesses of Ryan Reynolds and Mark Strong and the other actors. And again, it was a case where deadlines were so screwed up that stuff that I was looking for from the companies for reference, like what does this spaceship look like, or what does, I wound up getting it off of, like, they would refuse, oh, we can't send you this, or they'd send me a production drawing, and at the same time, it's like, oh, look, there's a new Green Lantern trailer that just hit the internet. I could go on that trailer and frame by frame do screen grabs to get the reference that they would not give me, and I just thought, wow, that is the same, and the same happened with Man of Steel, you know, there was these kind of flying dragon-like creatures that were on Krypton that they, Jor-El has one, and there's a couple of quick scenes, and nobody had any idea, nobody could give me reference on any of this stuff, and it was like, wait, there's a brief shot of it in the trailer, let me get a screen grab.
So life in the post-spoiler world, right?
Yeah, and it's funny, and again, you know, the difference in time is that in 1989, the Batman movie was filmed in Pinewood Studios, and I had been lucky enough to get a visit of the sets before they'd filmed, because I'd been at a convention in London in October of 88, and filming it didn't start, I think, until December or something, or whatever. We were like a month away, so the sets were pretty much built. And we got a wonderful tour of everything, and I got to see the Batmobile and the Bat costume and everything. And that was definitely before I even knew I was going to do the book. But it was definitely an incentive once I was asked by Jonathan Peterson again. He said, you know, we got a chance. We're always joking about how these movie comics have gotten so generic. Let's try to do one that kind of really looks like the movie and really reflects the movie. And we used it really as a way to get people back into the direct comic market, because,
sure,
you know, we got the DC circulation guy was able to get the movie book, the comic book, in movie theaters, which was a big deal. And they had the comic store locator in the ad in the back of it. And, you know, I mean, those were like outreach things that while DC couldn't afford to buy commercials, this movie is your biggest commercial, you know, and they don't really do that anymore. So you almost get a feeling, maybe I'm wrong, but I almost get a feeling that it kind of proves that the comics are more of a, oh, those are still around, you know, from the company's point of view. They used to be that used to be a good way to bring readers into your comic stores or to buy your books, was, oh, look, there's a big movie. And now I don't think there's that big bump. You know, maybe they experienced it a little bit with Black Panther, because Black Panther was so huge and it was kind of not a character that people had maybe seen in the mainstream. But generally, it feels like a wasted opportunity, I guess.
No, I agree. I feel sometimes the books are still just considered source material for other sources of revenue, and they kind of just use them as a farm, and they go pick the vegetables whenever they want, but they're not really tending to the farm so well.
Right. Well, and the worst thing that could happen is when you start hearing comic book characters referred to as IP. You know, once that started being a thing, that's corporate speak.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And IP doesn't necessarily refer to comics. It refers to maybe a catalog of products that you sell or that you can license, which just takes, you know, they're not just the characters in costumes. It's, these are stories, you know? So it does feel like that, as big as comic movies have been for years and years and years, it feels kind of like the comic market itself has become a little bit more, I guess, disposable to the companies in a way, you know?
And that's one of the things. I'm sorry.
I was just saying, I don't see Marvel. They're separate entities, so I don't see, like, you know, you make $2 billion off of some movie. I don't see Disney putting that into Marvel. In other words, they're not. Marvel's in a little fighter, you know, survival mode. Same with DC. Now that they're, you know, wings of bigger companies, they're basically having to fight for their existence. But yet the gigantic profits that might pour in from the movies are not coming back to the company. Like, hey, you can hire new people, or you can, you know, try new formats or something like that, or do advertising. None of that money comes back to Marvel or DC or any of those companies.
And the truth is, we know the comic book audience is shrinking, and I think it's largely because these companies aren't taking the time to sort of develop the next generation of comic book fans. And that's why it's encouraging for me to see a movie like Shazam, which obviously skews to a younger audience. Mm-hmm. Hopefully that'll be sort of a gateway for younger readers to get back into comics.
Yeah, well, I've been reading, and again, I've seen it a couple times already. I've been reading reviews. Reviews have been good. And I think it, in a way, it fits in with kind of how Deadpool hit, in that while they're vastly different, they both come at it from a lot more lighthearted, yet still serious, but more of a character-driven approach. And I think that's what fascinates me about the way they handled it, because when I did the graphic novel and when I did the series with Peter Krause as the penciler, and in the, like, 90, I guess that was 95 to 99, we were trying to do something that basically focused on what was different about Captain Marvel or Shazam versus Superman, you know, and the big difference is he's a kid.
Right.
You know, and I think things spring out naturally from that. And they did that perfectly in the movie. I mean, it's not exactly any of the comics. It's closer to the Geoff Johns, Gary Frank, New 52. But the tone of it is exactly what I, you know, imagined the Shazam movie would be, you know.
And that's always been the appeal of the character, I think, is that wish fulfillment of kids to read that and say, wow, wouldn't that be great if I could say a word and then become a superhero, just like my favorite characters.
Yeah, and I mean, when I did the graphic novel, one of the things that I threw in there which made sense to me is if you were, like, Billy was, say, 14, and he's suddenly an adult, he would be mad, like, hey, what did you do to me? I'm old, you know? Because, you as a writer, you always approach stuff and you think, when I was a kid, I remember graduating high school and going to community college, and I remember, because it was a community college, that there were a couple people in my geology class that were 25. And I thought, wow, they're really old. Why are they in college? You know, so it's always that, you know, sliding scale as far as what you perceive as old. And then I think of my mom, who was in her 70s, and she'd tell me, oh, I was on the bus, and there was this old lady who, and I went, wait, how old was she? You're 70.
Speaking of old, I'm glad you brought that up. It seems like with all your voluminous amount of work you've done over the decades, for some reason, when I think of your work, what resonates with me and pops out is your affinity for really bringing Golden Age characters to life. Maybe it's All-Star Squadron or Justice mm-hmm. Society of America or whatever that time period is, the Golden Age. You seem to have a particularly strong handle on those characters. Why do you think that is?
Well, I really like the characters, but I also, I think Roy Thomas kind of instilled in me a bigger amount of respect for those characters than I probably came into, because they were those characters, same with like Captain America and Namor, and you know, those characters really track back to the beginning of superhero comics or comics as we know. Same with Shazam, Captain Marvel.
Right.
There's a historical threat, and part of what I always liked about the Justice Society, for example, is that they coexisted within whatever the current DC universe was in their older versions. And that was kind of like, you know, you or me talking to, you know, some old person when we were kids about World War II or something. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, that there's a narrative thread, but it also felt like a real thread because, of course, a lot of people were involved fighting World War II. And that was always a link to me. When I was a kid, my mom had a tavern, and it mostly catered, she was only open during the day. She was open like from, I think it was 8 o'clock in the morning till 8 o'clock at night. And she still raised us because we lived at home. We lived in the back. But most of the customers during that whole day were all World War II and World War I veterans.
Wow.
So I was always, I didn't have a grandfather, you know, I mean, these people were kind of like that surrogate family thing, and they all had stories and they all had different points of view. You know, some of them were more damaged by whatever they went through than others. But I always had that instilled some respect in me for, hey, these people, you know, you're coming to and doing your own thing with life, but there's people who had major experiences beyond just having a bad day or whatever, you know, in combat or whatever. So that always was something I brought back into thinking about the JSA and the, the 1940s characters, that they were actually, again, you have to approach them like they're real. If you're writing them, you want to approach them as if they're real.
Mm-hmm. And I think you're right. The sense I always got from the younger characters in those books was there's wisdom to be gained here. I'm going to listen to these old timers because they've been there and done that, you know?
Right. And, you know, and as the older I got, I always felt like, you know, I was maybe even too young to appreciate everything because I still flash back on, you know, stories that I heard and things like that. But, you know, you always think, well, with your perspective of being, you know, I'm 60 now, I'm 61. You know, I think about that perspective and you think, oh, gee, I wish my mom was around to ask her questions about, or that I'd thought to ask questions about how she dealt with her 60s or how she dealt with aging or, you know, those are always the regrets you have because when you're young, you're not really, it's not that you're not equipped, it's just that you don't know what questions to ask.
Right.
But, like I said, that I still feel cheated in a way that the JSA was kind of taken out of circulation with the New 52. And because it felt like that was, again, like a link to DC's beginnings and a historical link that, from a reader's point of view, plus from the company's point of view, just you're like severing a tie, you know?
Well, your Jay Garrick Flash, I think, is my favorite version of that character ever. It's just outstanding.
And it's funny because I got to draw. I mean, that's the weird thing too. I drew them as young characters in All-Star Squadron, and then I drew them as older characters in Infinity Inc. and in the Justice Society comics in the, you know, 90s. So it was fun in a way to. I had specific, you know, visual models. Jay Garrick was a very specific one that I pulled from these books that came out years ago. I guess they were in the 70s. They were mostly for commercial artists called the Fairburn System. And they're like ring-bound 11x17 books of just nothing but pictures of people. Produced in England, but they have different ages. They have, you know, male, female, what have you. And the ones that's most helpful and has, you know, really been great for comics is the one with faces and heads, because they show turnaround. So you have characters from all angles. So if you were building a, you know, a specific character in a comic and you wanted to make them not generic, you'd pick somebody in here, and that would just give you, it would inform your drawing enough to not make it too much like the other guy or whatever, you know, it
right,
give you
sure.
a little distinction. So with Jay Garrick, when we were doing Infinity Inc. 1983, I picked, you know, an actor I thought, oh, this guy's got some kind of dignity, plus he has the heavy eyebrows, and that became my, you know, template. So whenever I drew Jay Garrick as an older guy in 1983 or 1993, you know, whatever, or 2003 or whatever, I use that same model. So he's consistent throughout my career, which is funny. So, and that you can't really say that for a lot of things because obviously the pictures don't age. So it's not like, oh, I'm going to use my neighbor and then your neighbor suddenly, you know, moves away or something. You know, I had the same model for this character for a long time. So it helps with the reader too. It gives them more of a sense that of consistency and, you know, makes it more real to them.
Well, I got to tell you, Jerry, I've kept you for a lot longer than I planned to, and I apologize for that, but this has just been a real joy having this conversation with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for asking. I mean, I'm happy to do anytime you want to. If you have any other questions or you want to do something, I know they're doing Batman stuff towards the end of the year. That's the 30th, or was it the 35th? What is it? 1989. Oh, wow.
The Batman film, 30-year anniversary, yeah.
Yeah, so it's 30 years from the comic adaptation, too, which is always mind-blowing. But
what are you up to these days? Do you get a lot of requests for work from fans and stuff who like to see you draw stuff for them? And
yeah,
I know you probably do the con circuit a ton.
Yeah, and I do commissions and things. I'm still working on comic stuff on my own. I've been trying to do some of my own characters that I had for years and years when I was a kid, you know, but it's always hard to find time, and also, you know, no one's paying me to do that, so it's harder to be able to justify not working on paying work for a month to try to do this or that. But I've been trying to force myself, and I still get, like, you know, comic stuff here and there. Like I'm working on a little thing for Marvel's 80th with Roy Thomas, actually.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's going to be I don't know if it's Invaders, but it's more like Captain America, all the characters individually in a story that Roy came up with to tie into, kind of All-Star Squadron, like he's tying it into a specific events at the beginning of World War II. And that's, like I said, that's something I think that comes out in the summer.
Well, I will be looking out for that, sir. Again, I cannot thank you enough for spending this time with me. It's been a real pleasure, and as I mentioned at the top of this, I'm such a huge fan of your work, and I look forward to seeing what you come up with next.
Okay, thank you very much.